I think we are a very digitally mature country. We started introducing electronic healthcare record systems in the 1980s, and we were fully digital in the late 90s, early, some around the millennia. I think Swedes are very demanding when it comes to public service. They want high quality service. It should be digital, it should be some efficient. And that's why we also, if they found a new service that is working more as a better than the old one, they are moving in large numbers to that new solution. And the adoption of digital care solutions or virtual meetings in healthcare, we went from 0 to 6 million visits a year in just 2 or 3 years. And that pushed the change for the entire healthcare system fairly quick. So I think it's a country where both the population and the care providers are fairly eager to find new ways of working. And it's easy to collaborate also between public and private, even if we're not perfect.
Welcome back to this new episode in which we meet Daniel Forslund, a true force for innovation in Sweden and an example of what can be done when people are curious enough to look for new solutions to old problems and then take advantage of the changing landscape. We will follow Daniel as his career unfolds along with the opportunities he identifies and chooses to follow. First as an engineer, then in both federal and local government, and finally on the private side of healthcare in Sweden, and at each step, helping Swedes innovate new solutions. I find his story so compelling and on so many levels because it shows what can be done even in a highly regulated, highly static context such as Sweden. As background, as of 2022, Sweden's population was approximately 10.5 million people, and Sweden's gross domestic product was approximately $635 billion. In 22, Sweden's health expenditure accounted for 10.5% of its GDP, so on the higher side, and public funding constituted 86% of total health expenditure. In other words, households were contributing no more than, say, 13-14% through fees and other charges. They have an aging population, with 20% being 65 or older and a high life expectancy of 83. Now, their birth rate is around 1.6, which is lower than replacement age, so rate, which is 2, and a diverse population, including many migrants, which comes with its own set of challenges. Now, Sweden has a universal healthcare system, which we'll discuss in some detail, with a strong prevention focus and a strong and established digital health backbone. All of this will come up in our conversation with Daniel. So I caught up with him in beautiful Gothenburg on a special and very spectacular spring day at a hotel that, as I walked in, I realized I'd been to a decade previously for an orthopedic event. It was one of two interviews that morning, the other being with an amazing physician, CEO of a healthcare startup called Anna Karen Bonamy, and we'll talk to her next. The two interviews are excellent and diametrically opposed perspectives on how to innovate in Sweden, one from a policy person trying to help innovators succeed, and the other from a person actually trying to innovate. Okay, let's get started with Daniel.
I've been living in Stockholm for 25 years now, and I've been focusing on the policy side of healthcare in my entire career. So I've been trying to find a place where I can foster a new culture of innovation or take away obstacles for implementing technologies in healthcare. I was actually starting my journey by thinking I was becoming an engineer because I like tech. But then I realized that I don't want to develop tech. I want to make tech usable for people or for society. I shifted to public policies and political science. So my first job was in the Ministry of Health in Sweden, where I, after a year or so, was asked to take responsibility over the IT matters in the ministry in the healthcare department. And I was very young, but I was also very, I think I was a bit young and brave to ask the questions everyone was supposed to be asking, but they didn't, because it was so tight and locked down and very tense between the regions in Sweden and the national government, the tech companies and all the other stakeholders, because everyone was blaming each other. So I, as a young civil servant in the ministry, I got the mandate to start a process where we tried to find a common ground on how to proceed on IT investments, on IT adoptions in healthcare, and actually understand what are the obstacles and why are we not moving forward faster. And this was 2004, so 20 years ago. So I stayed with the ministry for, I think, 10 years almost. Then I felt I need to move ahead to make innovation happen even further, not only to work on policies and legislation, but also to work with innovation more hands-on. So I moved to the National Innovation Agency in Sweden called Vinnova. So I worked there as a chief strategy officer for 3.5 years, where we built innovation programs for care providers, tech companies, academia, that could work together to try new ways with the public funding, public seed funding for innovation, so to say. So that was really fun to be more hands-on with that work and learn also more about the problems with implementation of all the policies that they're working with at the ministry.
What a great story here from Daniel. Almost gives you hope in government and public systems, doesn't it? There's a certain humility in realizing that maybe there are great ideas playing out elsewhere, and that spending time outside one's comfort zone, particularly with colleagues, can have two important benefits. The first is that the team is introduced to new ideas that will challenge their thinking. The second is that the team now has a shared data set, a shared language, and shared reference points through which to communicate. I'm sure everyone listening has had the experience of coming across something new and trying to bring it back to their team, finding it had to persuade people back home that what you saw is possible, and not just possible somewhere else, but possible in your own context. Daniel's story is a great example how if you send a team, not individuals, to conferences or fact-finding missions, they can actually come back richer than if you actually send out a single individual. I think it's very important, especially for the conference we run, the Digital Orthopedics Conference San Francisco, where we really try to bring teams together to have a shared language with which to go home with. Anyhow, let's now focus on government initiatives in Sweden.
When I moved from the ministry to the innovation agency, suddenly I could work closer together with entrepreneurs and innovators and all those individuals who have ideas on how to do things differently. In the ministry, I was more boxed in a way. I couldn't move as freely as I could in the innovation agency because as a civil servant, you were supposed to not talk to industry or to vendors or to the tech companies. And if I did, I have to talk through vendor organizations, or if two companies say that we can't pick one vendor for the other, so we don't talk to anyone. And that wasn't very fruitful. So I wished that we had created a more close collaboration with frontline tech companies and also the freest thinking innovators early in that process, because we were a bit too focused on the formal processes, because we needed formality to make change happen in the government agencies or at the Association for Regions and Municipalities or other formal bodies. So that was our main struggle, to get the policies in place for making progress happen. It's like when forming the ONC in the US, I said we had to form a body that could actually work with these issues on the national level. So that was my work, but it was more directed inwards in the public system or the formal system, not to the more decentralized or unorganized innovation system. I think what was good during that period, we started to tear down those walls between public and private and between the industry side and the customer side by doing delegation trips together. For example, we visited England and the NHS. We went on study trips to Denmark. We went to HIMSS US and assembled a large group of care providers, government authorities, vendors, patient organizations in a delegation with 200 people from Sweden. And then we can actually learn something together and also discuss what we learned in the US or in Denmark or where we were. And that was a very good way that moved the agenda forward, because we built trust between all these entities. And I think that's a strong point for Sweden. We don't have that anxiety in meeting public-private anymore, I think, as it's much less sensitive to have those conversations between a government authority and a vendor, for example, because we need that knowledge from both sides and we need to adopt public policy to what can tech companies actually provide. And especially now when we are discussing a lot of standardization initiatives from a national government and so on.
What a great story here from Daniel. Almost gives you hope in government and public system, doesn't it? There's a certain humility in realizing that maybe there are great ideas playing out elsewhere, and that spending time outside one's comfort zone, particularly with colleagues, can have two important benefits. The first is that the team is introduced to new ideas that will challenge their thinking. The second is that the team now has a shared data set, a shared language, and shared reference points through which to communicate. I'm sure everyone listening has had the experience of coming back from an exciting meeting and trying to get their teams to understand what they're talking about. Daniel's story is a great example of the value of sending teams and individuals to conferences of fact-finding missions. Well, let's now focus on government initiatives in Sweden.
today?
But we have a new government since 2 years, more or less, and they set out as actually the first government that put this in the founding principles for the coalition, that they wanted a digital reform for healthcare and welfare. And that reform is targeting the lack of the common digital infrastructure in Sweden. Not infrastructure as in the physical infrastructure, because we have that. We are very digitalized, but don't have the soft infrastructure in principles or standards or common regulations on how, so which data format to use and how should systems be interoperable, or how could we prevent data blocking between providers and or systems. So that is the main target for the government, to make our regionalized healthcare system be more national and more coherent in some way. And IT, and as a perhaps the architecture behind it and how you form principles and guidelines or actual legislation that makes it easier for a vendor to develop some new systems or apps, because you know which principles to follow. If I follow these 10 principles, my solution will be interoperable with my competitors. And as a care provider, I can buy any of these 4 systems and I know that they are compliant to the national regulations. Today, we don't have that. So we try to compare to the development that was made in the telecom sector like 40 years ago when we formed the GSM or 3G or 4G standards. That makes it possible for you and I can have different phones, different operators, and we can sit here in Sweden and you can still phone with your American SIM card. And it's, you have those principles in place with full competition between all the companies who are providing us phones or network equipment or building operators. But still, there is a framework that you follow. We lack that in healthcare, and we need that on the global level as well, I think.
Interestingly, in Sweden, there's a proposal to build a new collaboration governance structure that will include both public and private care providers, the vendor side, the authorities, and also the regions in Sweden that are financing healthcare. So it's a huge process that was just starting when I was there. It is interesting how the government is supporting innovation, and we will hear a little more about that next.
I have a national authority for that. As I mentioned, I was working there for 3.5 years. It's called Vinnova, and that's a national state-run authority who has grants from the government to fund innovation projects. So they have open calls where you can have a call for tenders for a specific goal. Challenges that you want to address in healthcare, for example, okay, how can we work with empowering patients through technologies or mobility and treatment in their homes, for example? And then you can form a project with a couple of tech companies, so some care providers and some other stakeholders that join forces to try to solve something. Then there are regional funds from the EU, one called the European Structural Funds and one the European Social. So it's also possible to apply for European funding for innovation through a regional structure. European is like a partnership on the regional level between the industry and the local public bodies that then have a process for application and funding of those kind of projects. And then there's hundreds of science parks and local initiatives where there's also can be hands-on support for how to succeed with your project or get help in implementation and so on. And that's actually why I then moved from the national authority to, and I went to the region of Stockholm. We have the regions are organizing healthcare and funding healthcare in Sweden, and they levy their own taxes, and it's based on the regional side as in Germany or other countries. And there I was elected to political office because my ambition was to also change not only the seed funding from public or private entities, but also need to be incentivizing innovation in the ordinary reimbursement systems in healthcare, for example. So then I felt, okay, I need to be on the political side to change those kind of regulations or mandates or budgetary principles that this needs to be in place to change the reimbursement in healthcare. So in Stockholm, I was commissioner for innovation, and then we started a big process of building our own innovation support system within the region and also changing our reimbursement system so that care providers should feel incentivized of changing things, because the reimbursement system says that you're only reimbursed if you meet the patient in a physical room and not on a screen when you don't have virtual online meetings. So we did a lot of work in trying to clear up those kind of obstacles for innovation, because you can't only have seed funding in the projects. You need to be working on the adoption side, as it's that projects actually are adopted and not products anymore, but they are actually just implemented and being a part of everyday healthcare. So that was my ambition, to change the regional policies on how you govern healthcare and incentivize healthcare providers to be better, so that healthcare providers are better customers for these tech companies, for example, but they can sell these products to healthcare in an easier way. I left for 2 years ago, so I was there for 7 years. So we built that organization and we changed a lot of the internal governance structures that actually are in place still today. So it's a good case, I think, to look at the capital region of Stockholm and how we work with innovation.
At this point in the conversation, I was really impressed. It seems that at every stage in his career, if Daniel found a problem that needed a solution, he just tackled it. And then when he had more or less fixed what he set out to fix, he tackled the next biggest obstacle that he had been finding in his prior job. To that speaks to a curiosity mindset, right? One that does not take the status quo as an answer, but asks the question, hey, how can we do this better, right? Are these really the best solutions? Can you incentivize? Can you innovate through ordinary reimbursement systems? These are big questions. So let's see, we're now in Stockholm and he's trying to solve for something we call the last mile problem, basically the challenge of getting from a pilot to broad implementation. So let's see how his team approached this task and how it worked out.
We try to work on three levels to get, first and foremost, the mandate for healthcare providers and the clinical staff to work with innovation, that this is a part of your daily life. You shouldn't only be working with the production of healthcare, as we didn't call it about. We talk about the production side and the policy side. And if you just produce operating procedures or number of visits, and you are measured only in doing that, you do that and you don't work with research and development or innovation, or, and by law, it's actually in your mandate that you should always develop your way of using technologies or how you use treatments or therapies, but still it comes last on the list of what other things you should do. So we bumped that up as a measurement, that we measure care providers that you actually do work with innovation, and they are incentivized if they succeed and if we have a way of measuring the change that they actually are doing. So mandate for the first thing. The second one was funding. So we started an internal innovation fund to shorten the time frame for not having to apply from external funding from EU or from a national level. So you have also a small internal budget for seed funding for individual clinics in our public hospitals, for example. And this last thing was as a measurements, as to really in the monitoring of quality and outcomes in healthcare, we also monitored the change process in a different way, and we tried to put metrics in our budgetary system to see the value of innovation. And that was much harder because we don't have that standardized in any level, I think, but still we tried. That's what was the idea, because looking at projects who only lived on seed money or project funding, it was harder to get implementation in place, because the organization who made the pilot, they didn't risk anything, and they, as soon as the money was taken away, the project died. But if you have risked your own money and you invested in the change process as a care provider, you wanted this to succeed and you wouldn't want to risk that portion of money that you actually had put in place for the change. And that made it easier to get a higher hit rate of projects actually being implemented and actually being innovations, not only crazy ideas. So we did a measurement of our internal innovation fund where we can see that I think it was like between 60 and 70% of all projects were actually implemented, and not all was disseminated across the system, but many were. And the survival rate of projects were higher than the ordinary innovation project with external money. Because when you co-founded in that way, it was much easier to get implementation to happen, because you built both an understanding of how you should implement it, since the organization was more a part of the innovation process, and they also had something to risk and something to gain by implementing it. So I think it's a good way of getting that some handshake between the innovation world and the healthcare world. Otherwise, it's only one party that will win, and that's not the case for making progress, I think.
This idea of skin in the game, that grant funding should be a two-way street, is not entirely novel, but is not widely practiced. Huh? In some ways, this is how venture works. One person adds capital, the other adds assets, and both are committed to success because failure is shared. Incentives are therefore aligned. So next I ask about how funds actually flow into innovation in healthcare and what challenges remain for healthcare startups in Sweden, but this is an extraordinarily important point.
Starting with the money flows, I think in this area, it's mostly national money, since healthcare systems are very national. So we have collaborations both in the Nordics on the European level, but still it's on a more research level or as a highly specialized care, for example. But I think most of the funding is done by national entities. So in Denmark, they have a lot of big private funds from pharmaceutical companies who have a funding mechanism, for example, for startups or for partner programs. In Sweden, we have some of that. It's a mix of public funding from private companies or private equity funds, or then, what's it called, these more family foundations. So we have some of them also investing a lot of, exactly, for example, in AI research now from Wallenberg Foundation. Is one of the big industry families in Sweden. They have invested a couple of billion kroner in AI development, for example. And then there's a big public funding from both national level, regional level, and the EU level. And because the EU funds are huge when it comes to research and innovation funds. It's hundreds of millions of euros that you can apply from only in Sweden. I don't know the proportions between the public and private, but it's a mix. And then if you are an entrepreneur wanting to access healthcare, we have had a very successful series of entrepreneurs becoming care providers from the tech side. 10 years ago, two companies started with the idea to solve the problems of accessing healthcare in an easy way in primary care. So they launched the first versions of online consultation apps for some between doctors and patients. And that was highly debated in Sweden for a couple of years. But now those companies have become some of the largest primary care companies in Sweden. So one of the companies called Kry, it's also listed in England as Livy, for example, or France. They now have 250,000 people listed in their health centers. And they are, I think they had done like 10 million visits online since the start. And annually, we are doing 6 million online consultations now. And that was made only, I think, because we had a process where private entrepreneurs could actually access public funding and challenge the way we are providing healthcare and showing that, okay, online consultation is actually possible. And thank God we did that before the pandemic, because then we were very equipped for shifting from physical to online consultations in just a couple of weeks or months in 2000. We always talk about the innovation journey, when it's perhaps easy to start up and then it's very hard to grow or to get your first customers. And your question before about where do you find your clients in health tech world in Sweden, it's the public side of healthcare is fairly hard to reach when you come with a new idea or a challenging way of introducing new technology. And that has forced many other companies, health tech companies, to find their first customer in Denmark or in the US instead. Many actually launch in California or somewhere because that's a community where you are welcomed as a tech entrepreneur. And in healthcare, it's a struggle to find even which door should I knock on to get an answer, yes or no, could I even try this? It's a labyrinth of bureaucracy that you have to know about, and you don't know that if you're come from a tech side, you can't understand healthcare. So that's why there's been a lot of initiatives to fast track that kind of innovation into the system. And now I work for the Organization of Private Care Providers. We have 2,000 healthcare companies working mainly with public funding, but they are a bit more free how to buy new tech or procure new models. So they can be a first customer for those companies in perhaps easier way. But we are trying to find ways of having one entry point for your innovative idea, and then you can get some kind of test bed that you can try it in, that we have a more network of test beds so that could be used. It's in the early days still.
So at this point, it's probably a good idea to get a little clarity about how the system actually works in Sweden. There seems to be private and government, and I was actually not super clear on how they interacted as a market. So I asked for a quick overview.
Okay, it's not a national system like the English one, for example. It's a regional-based system. So we have 21 regions in Sweden, and they are responsible for financing and organizing healthcare within their region. So it's an old structure based from the 16th century or something. It's been there forever. But still, there's now an ongoing discussion on should we have a more national governance model for healthcare. But still, it's 21 regions that are having the full mandate for providing healthcare. And also the funding comes from the regions, not from a national level. There are some national as a government grants, but it's only a proportion like 5 to 10% of the total budget in healthcare is from the national level. Everything else is based on regional tax. So as a citizen in Stockholm, I pay local tax, regional tax for healthcare, and then national tax for defense and things like that. So that means that the requirements for health can be different in different regions because they set their own rules and regulations on how to implement technologies, for example. There's a national framework and collaboration between regions, but still it's not one way to do things. It's decided, it's very decentralized in that way. And that makes it hard for tech companies or care providers who provide care in different parts of a country, for example. And the government's mandate is to set the overall legislation for guaranteeing the access to healthcare or overall policies on patient safety and national care plans and guide for treatment and so on. And the ministry has not, I don't know how many, but five big agencies for pharmaceuticals and medical devices, for e-health and data and for health insurance and things like that. So there's a lot of government agencies then working more hands-on to support the regions and the private care providers. That was a reform that was introduced, I think, in the early 90s, because in the 1980s and back, there was a regional monopoly for providing healthcare. So we only had public providers, some private secure social insurance-based private companies, but still 99% was publicly run. But then there was a big problem with queues and waiting times. The government in the early 1990s introduced a free choice of care provider reform where you opened up for the free establishment of care providers with public funding that could be, well, doctors could start their own company and have a health clinic, or some public hospitals were opened up for procurement of another company could run them, for example. And that has been introduced in all the regions and at different levels. So in Stockholm, the ratio in primary care is, I think, 67% private and 33% public amongst health clinics. In another smaller region, it's a different ratio. It's 80% public and 20% private. So it's based on also regional political decisions on how easy it is to start a care provider in that region, for example. But I think the overall ratio on the national average is that in primary care, it's 50-50, public and private. And in specialized care, I think it's like somewhere below 20% specialized care is private and 80% is publicly run. But it varies across the regions and across specialties.
Okay, so we're kind of wrapping it up. And at this point in the conversation, it was time to look forward, to look towards the future and get a sense of where Sweden is going as a country and as a place to innovate, at least from Daniel's perspective.
Much focus is on looking at the incentives for innovation and also the basic governance models for healthcare. So there's one big government inquiry about how should healthcare in Sweden be run in the future, looking at reforms in Norway and Denmark, for example, or in the Netherlands, where they have changed the reimbursement and organized as a governance model. Denmark went from 12 to 5 regions and took away the funding from the regions and made it more a more national system. So that is one model we are looking at. So there's a big inquiry trying to find the next organizational model for Swedish healthcare. So that's one big challenge. The other one is, as I mentioned in the beginning, the digital infrastructure, as of the soft infrastructure, to set a framework for how should all the systems and providers be interoperable with full competition, but still under the same rules. The third thing is, I think, is the actual reimbursement systems on how, as a care provider, how can I use the best accessible technology for solving this issue for you as a patient, and not having too much detail in the reimbursement system or in the care agreements, so that you are free to use the most efficient technology. And that's not the case because it's detailed in a very tech specific way. This diagnosis you should meet in this way or do this procedure, or and this slowing down in innovation and the adoption of new technology, I think. So those three, I think, is the main topics. I think we are a very digitally mature country. We started introducing electronic healthcare record systems in the 1980s, and we were fully digital in the late 90s, early around the millennia. I think Swedes are very demanding when it comes to public service. They want high quality service. It should be digital. It should be some efficient. And that's why we also, if they found a new service that is working more as a better than the old one, they are moving in large numbers to that new solution. And the adoption of digital care solutions or virtual meetings in healthcare, we went from 0 to 6 million visits a year in just 2 or 3 years. Because if your local health clinic only have a telephone device in the morning. I can use my app and get online in 5 minutes and meet my doctor. Why shouldn't I use that? And everyone did. And that pushed the change for the entire healthcare system fairly quick. So I think it's a country where both the population and the care providers are fairly eager to find new ways of working. And it's easy to collaborate also between public and private, even if we're not perfect, but still it's, I think it's easier here than in many countries in Europe at least. And we are solving the big struggles when, as we talked about, the governance models and reimbursement systems. It's up for so much discussion, so there will be significant improvement, I think, in that aspect as well. So
different perspectives on a huge task to innovate healthcare. You need to understand national government, regional government, private, and also the investment side of it, because otherwise it's hard to understand where are the actual obstacles, which is a perceived obstacle, which is an actual obstacle. It's not always the same.
And that's a wrap on our conversation with Daniel. I hope you're inspired by his life's journey and to some extent empowered by his success as what one might call a policy entrepreneur or a health policy entrepreneur, a person I would define as driving digital health transformation from the policy side. Next up will be our interview with Dr. Anna Karen Bonamy on her journey as a healthcare entrepreneur that started as the daughter of a nurse working in a remote region of Sweden where she was the only care provider for tens and tens of miles. I'm confident you'll enjoy her story. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I'll reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.